This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Wednesday, November 30, 2005. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. Advocates on both sides of the abortion issue pay attention as Chief Justice John Roberts hears his first abortion case. Gay rights activists rally throughout Poland, demanding tolerance and freedom of speech from Poland's new conservative leaders.
We are fed up with homophobia in Poland and with the opinion that we're crazy.
And international reactions as death row inmate Robin Lovett is granted clemency. We'll bring you these stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The International Criminal Court in The Hague handed down its first verdict today relating to alleged war crimes committed against Serb and Albanian civilians during the 1998-1999 civil conflict in Kosovo. Jackson Allers has more from Pristina.
Bands of independence-minded ethnic Albanians, who constitute 90% of Kosovo's population, celebrated The Hague's decision today to acquit Kosovo Liberation Army commander Fatmir Limaj for alleged war crimes committed during the guerrilla insurrection in the last civil conflict in the former Yugoslavia. Limaj was charged with establishing an illegal prison camp that allegedly tortured prisoners. He was also charged with chain of command culpability for the executions of a group of 9 Serbs and their alleged Albanian collaborators. 2 other KLA fighters under Fatmir Limaj's command were also charged with the crimes. Although the court found no evidence linking Limaj and another indictee, Isak Muslu, with torture or murder, the presiding judge said the prosecution had successfully proven the existence of a prison camp near Pristina. A third indictee, Haradin Bala, was sentenced to 13 years and convicted of torture and murder at the same prison camp. Kosovo has been under United Nations control since 1999, following the unilateral NATO bombing campaign of the former Yugoslavia. Kosovo's former prime minister, Ramush Haradinaj, has also been indicted for war crimes and is awaiting trial at The Hague. From Kosovo, I'm Jackson Allers reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
The British civil rights group Liberty is threatening to take the British government and senior police officers to court if they fail to prove they've investigated reports that CIA torture flights have landed in Britain or used British airspace. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
According to reports, aircraft used by the CIA transferring detained terrorist suspects to interrogation centres where they're likely to be tortured, known as rendition, have flown into the UK at least 210 times since the 9/11 attacks. Complicity of any kind in torture violates British law, international law, and European and UN human rights conventions. Up till now, government ministers have cut short parliamentary questions about the flights, claiming the British government has no knowledge of them. But today, the civil rights group Liberty has written to Foreign Secretary Jack Straw and to senior police officers, giving them 2 weeks to disclose what they know about the flights. If they fail to show they've investigated the allegations, Liberty will then take them to court to demand a judicial review. The Council of Europe is investigating the allegations against various EU member states. European Justice and Home Affairs Commissioner Franco Frattini has threatened EU member states found to have cooperated with the so-called torture flights, with a loss of voting rights. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
Today is the 10th anniversary of Lori Berenson's incarceration in Peru. Berenson was pulled off of a public bus in Lima by security forces, charged with collaboration with the Tupac Amaru Revolutionary Movement, and later sentenced to life in prison by a hooded military tribunal. Her sentence was later reduced by a civilian court. She is scheduled for release in 2015. Peace talks to end the crisis in Sudan's Darfur region have resumed today in Nigeria's capital. Sama Lakoya reports from Lagos.
The peace talks include representatives of the Sudanese government and rebels operating in the Darfur region. Although the negotiations have been on for about a year without success, the rebels say they are hopeful that a final agreement will be reached during this latest round of talks. The split among the rebel groups is blamed for the failure of previous talks. This time the rebels will present a united front. An upsurge in fighting has further underscored the need to urgently end the crisis. African Union peacekeepers in the region were recently killed in the face of repeated ceasefire violations. The Darfur crisis started 2 years ago when rebels of black African origin took up arms against the Arab-dominated government. They accused the Sudanese government of discriminating against black Africans. The crisis escalated when pro-government Arab militias started attacking the African population. Over 70,000 people have died in 2 years of conflict in the Darfur region, and more than a third of Darfur's 6 million inhabitants have fled their homes. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
A Nepalese FM radio station is now back on the air after a government raid shut it down on Sunday. Binu Alex has more from Ahmedabad.
Nepal's Supreme Court has lifted a government order against Radio Sagarmatha, South Asia's oldest community radio station. Five of the radio's staff members were arrested on Sunday when security forces raided the station. Within hours of the court's ruling, the government of Nepal asked Radio Sagarmatha not to air the BBC's Nepalese service. Plans to broadcast a controversial interview with the leader of Nepal's Maoist insurgency is thought to have provoked Sunday's raid. Although the five staffers have been released from jail, confiscated equipment has not been returned. A government decree issued after King Gyanendra's coup prohibits the broadcast of news content on almost all of Nepal's 40 FM radio stations. From Ahmedabad in India, I'm Binu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi announced today that she supports Congressman John Murtha's plan of withdrawing from Iraq in 6 months.
I'm endorsing what Mr. Murtha is saying, which is that the status quo is not working and that we need to have a plan that makes us safer, military stronger, and makes Iraq more stable. I believe that what he has said has great wisdom. While the president is digging a hole, Mr. Murtha is speaking from the light of day about the realities in Iraq. So, yes, I am supporting what Mr. Murtha is putting forth.
This is a change to Pelosi's original stand on Murtha's plan, and she made the announcement after President Bush's speech today in front of the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland, concerning his strategy in Iraq. Listing key steps for victory, Bush called the Democrats' demand for a withdrawal timetable, quote, an artificial deadline, unquote. Meanwhile, U.S. Ambassador to Iraq Zalmay Khalilzad is reported to be making contacts with some armed groups in Iraq with the goal of reaching a political settlement. Anastasia Nestitska has more from D.C.
In his speech, in which the president addressed the graduates of the Naval Academy, he shared the key points of the new document released by the White House called National Strategy for Victory in Iraq. Bush said these elements include the training of security forces, the building of political institutions, the isolation of terrorists, and the reconstruction of the infrastructure. The culmination of the speech was the president's claim that in order to achieve these goals that would lead up to a complete victory, further U.S. presence in Iraq is necessary.
Victory in Iraq will demand the continued determination and resolve of the American people. And as the future officers of the United States Navy and Marine Corps, you're preparing to join this fight. You do so at a time when there is a vigorous debate about the war in Iraq. I know that for our men and women in uniform, this debate can be unsettling. When you're risking your life to accomplish a mission, the last thing you want to hear is that mission being questioned in our nation's capital. I want you to know that while there may be a lot of heated rhetoric in Washington, D.C., one thing is not in dispute. The American people stand behind you.
In a response to the speech, Senator Kerry asserted that if the upcoming elections in Iraq are successful and the Iraqis are capable of defending themselves, further U.S. presence is far from necessary.
Every one of us supports the elections that are going to take place in a few weeks. They will give Iraq the opportunity to be able to move forward with a government that is going to be there for a longer period of time. The success of those elections, ladies and gentlemen, provides a benchmark of success which allows you then to be able to withdraw some of the troops. This comes to the fundamental issue that the president avoided today. It ignores what the Iraqis themselves are telling us today. General Casey has said that it is the large presence of American forces on the ground that feeds the insurgency and makes it more difficult for the Iraqis to assume responsibility because they don't have to.
According to a report by Al Jazeera, U.S. envoy in Iraq Zalmay Khalilzad was seeking to make contacts with some of the armed groups in Iraq, particularly with Saddamists and the Zarqawi group associated with jihadists. Khalilzad told ABC television on Tuesday that he was seeking talks with neighboring Iran to help in the fight against resistance. It comes as an acknowledgement of the fact that stability in the region is not achievable without Iran. Senator Kerry has evaluated the envoy's initiatives as very important. U.S. State Department spokesman Sean McCormack rebuffed Khalilzad's initiatives by stating that he actually has a very narrow mandate. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Anastasia Gnezditskaya in Washington, D.C.
As we reported yesterday, a video showing four men taken hostage was released by Al Jazeera. The four are members of the Christian Peacemaker Team, one of the last remaining human rights groups working in Iraq since the U.S.-led invasion in 2003, has focused on documenting the human rights abuses of Iraqi prisoners and detainees. The Christian Peacemaker Team, or CPT, was the first organization to publicly identify and denounce the torture of Iraqi people at the hands of U.S. forces in prisons long before the Western media exposed what was happening. KPFA's Salam Talib spoke with Anita David, a CPT team member on the ground in Iraq, about how CPT came to document the abuse of Iraqi detainees and the conditions of their imprisonment.
The detainee report began because people were coming to our door and telling us about things that had happened to their family members. People had been arrested, or there had been house raids where U.S. soldiers came in at night and would embarrass and shame people because women would be seen with their hair uncovered and men would be put on the floor with their faces down in front of their children, in front of their families, and then they would be taken away. There was no, their doors would be broken and the house would be wrecked by everybody pouring, by the soldiers pouring through there and pulling out drawers and yanking open doors and things like that. And so people began to come to our home, our house, to tell us about these things. So we began to try and interview people. The other problem was that nobody could find their family member. There was no way to learn where the mother, somebody's father or son or brother had been taken, you know? So we tried initially to follow up on that, to try and find people who had been taken.
What's the background for CPT, Christian Peacemaker Team? They are related in any way to the government, or they have any influence on government, or they have any connections with the government? What's their perspective about religion? They are a religion organization?
We come from many traditions, but our work is based in peace. We receive no money from the government at all. We do not proselytize. We do not believe in changing anybody's faith.
Do you believe that, that God forbid, if something happened for your team, are these feelings will be changed about Iraqis?
This is not done by all Iraqis any more than this occupation is done by all Americans. You know what I mean? Iraqi people understand justice. It would break my heart if something happened to my teammates. They are people who wished only to go back to their homes and say something, to speak about the indecency taking place here, and to try to change people's minds.
Salam Talib spoke with Anita David, a Christian Peacemaker team member on the ground in Iraq. Chief Justice John Roberts heard his first abortion case today over a New Hampshire law that requires minors to notify their parents 48 hours before they have an abortion. Advocates on both sides of the abortion debate see the case as an important precursor to what lies ahead. Mitch Jezerich reports from Washington.
In a rare move, the Supreme Court released audio from today's oral arguments on a New Hampshire law requiring parental notification for minors seeking an abortion. But the case did not focus on whether a teen can have such a procedure independent of her parents, but whether the New Hampshire law adequately protects the health in a medical emergency of the minor. New Hampshire Attorney General Kelly Ayotte was challenged by Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer on this point.
15-year-old walks in at 2 in the morning on Saturday into the emergency room, and the doctor looks at her. She's pregnant. She has this very high blood pressure, whatever. And the doctor thinks to himself, well, immediate abortion, no question. Immediately deliver the child. If I don't, I don't think she's going to die, but she'll never have children.
Justice Breyer, the physician in those instances could perform the immediate abortion.
And it doesn't say that in the statute. It suggests the contrary.
Your Honor, his lawyer would advise him in those circumstances that the competing harms defense would protect his actions.
U.S. Solicitor General Pat Clement argued in favor of the New Hampshire law.
What you have before you is really a case where it's literally a 1 in 1,000 possibility that there's going to be an emergency where the statute won't operate. And the real question for you is, faced with that kind of case, do you invalidate 1,000 applications of the statute, noting that 999 of them are constitutional?
Jennifer Dalvin argued on behalf of Planned Parenthood Federation of America. She was challenged by Justice Antonin Scalia.
Once a minor arrives in the emergency room, it is too late for her to go to court. There is, as we said, every minute is critical, and any delay from the time that the doctor faces a pregnant teen determines that she must have an immediate abortion. Any delay from that point forward puts the minor's health at risk.
Well, surely not the delay for a quick phone call. Let's assume New Hampshire sets up a special office open 24 hours a day, and this is the abortion judge, and he can be reached anytime, anywhere.
What would be the purpose in such a statute? If all you had to do was literally call a number and the judge would say, okay, if the judge had no time, the nurse had no time to relay the facts, the judge had no time to ask any questions, the judge had no time to consider the evidence.
The culture wars were in full swing just outside of the court. Demonstrators both for and against the right to choose an abortion gathered and sometimes clashed while oral arguments proceeded. Both sides see the case as an important precursor to the fate of Roe v. Wade. Crystal Lander is the campus program director of Feminist Majority Foundation.
I'm carrying a coat hanger because I want people to remember what it was like before Roe was legal. This is something that happened on a regular basis to women who look like me. I'm a black woman, and I know that if abortion becomes illegal, rich women, mostly white women, will still be able to afford to have abortions in their doctor's offices. But women who are young and women who are minorities tend to be the ones who resort to methods like coat hangers, and it's happening. It's happening now in developing countries, but it will happen here, and that scares me.
Crystal Camacho, also a woman of color, was protesting against the right to an abortion.
If they vote on protection of having parental protection over the kids, that will be a sign for us, you know, saying that there's a shifting in the courts taking place, you know, and it gives us an open door for overturning abortion, I believe.
President Bush's Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito could weigh in on the case if he is confirmed by the Senate before the court reaches its decision. Mitch Jezerich, Free Speech Radio News.
Texas death row inmate Tony Ford received a 30-day stay of execution last night while investigators proceeded with further DNA testing. 14 years ago, Ford was convicted for the murder of Armando Murillo. Murillo's mother and one of his sisters were injured in the same shooting. His mother was shot in the head and is permanently disabled. Ford has always maintained his innocence in the crime and has alleged that another man, Victor Belton, was responsible for the shooting. Belton was arrested on another charge that occurred on the same day after the murder. Richard Burr is one of Tony Ford's attorneys and describes what happened after the other man, Victor Belton, was arrested.
his clothing and shoes were taken by the jail when he was arrested, and they have been kept for now 14 years. And we asked in a motion filed last week that the state trial judge order an examination of the clothing and shoes to see if there was any biological material on them that might be subject to DNA testing. Today, the crime lab in El Paso has determined that there is blood on Victor Belton's clothing, and the judge has ordered that they do DNA testing on that and compare it to the DNA of the crime victims.
That was Richard Burr discussing new DNA testing in Tony Ford's case. Virginia Governor Mark Warner has commuted the death sentence of Robin Lovett to life without parole. The case has captured international attention as the U.S. moves towards executing the 1,000th prisoner since the reinstatement of the death penalty, and because a court employee willfully destroyed all of the physical evidence during the appeals process, thus preventing modern DNA testing and possible exoneration from murder charges. From Richmond, FSRN's Catherine Comp has reactions to the governor's clemency decision.
More than a dozen defense lawyers worked on Robin Lovett's case for the past several years, including attorney Ashley Parrish.
Kirkland & Ellis LLP is gratified that Governor Warner has exercised his executive power of clemency to commute Mr. Lovett's sentence to life in prison. We believe this decision to be entirely proper given the extraordinary circumstances of Mr. Lovett's case.
Clemency in Virginia is often the only recourse for defendants of capital charges, including Lovett, who exhausted all of his appeals in the 1998 murder case of an Arlington pool hall manager. Executive Director of the Virginia ACLU, Kent Willis, says one of the major problems was the state's harsh 21-day rule that until 2001 prevented the introduction of any new evidence 21 days after sentencing in capital cases.
No one wants the final determination to be made by a politician. The system worked this time because Governor Warner saw what he had to do, but it doesn't mean the system always works. The death penalty in Virginia is a very flawed system, and it should have worked through the court system. It didn't this time.
Despite ACLU studies highlighting these flaws, Virginia lawmakers have lagged in fixing the system. Virginia House of Delegates Representative Vince Callahan, a former supporter of the death penalty, could not rally any support for his 2002 bill proposing a two-year moratorium.
I think the death penalty is broken and it needs fixing. Not to me, it needs abolition, but at the very least, you should have a moratorium so you can look at what all the problems. You have all this DNA stuff coming out now. That's relatively new to the history. And occasionally somebody will slip through there who's innocent and gets executed.
DNA evidence was key in proving the wrongful convictions of more than 100 death row inmates over the last two decades, according to Rennie Cushing, executive director of Murder Victims Families for Human Rights. He applauds Governor Warner's decision, but says the state needs to do more.
Here in Virginia, you have lingering questions about cases that probably involve people who were wrongfully put to death in the Commonwealth. And I think that it's important that Virginia take a little time out, if you will, impose a moratorium, and move away from the death penalty.
In a statement, Governor Warner said his decision is based solely on the misconduct of a state employee destroying the physical evidence. In Richmond, I'm Catherine Kamp for Free Speech Radio News.
Over 3.5 years ago, 18-year-old Bennett Patricio was killed by a Border Patrol officer driving a vehicle on the Tohono O'odham Reservation's Highway 20 near Tucson. U.S. Border Patrol agent Cody Roos struck Bennett Patricio and dragged his body at least 50 feet before stopping. When the agent called in to report the incident, he simply claimed there was a body on the side of the road and did not admit that he struck Bennett Patricio until later in the investigation. Patricio's mother, Angelita Ramon, was told by police officers that her son was killed. She then waited days, weeks, and months to hear an apology for her son's death from the Border Patrol, but never got one. A trial is now underway in a U.S. district court charging the U.S. government with responsibility for Patricio's death. Wake Up Call's Deepa Fernandez spoke with Bennett Patricio's mother, Angelita Ramon, about the trial.
From the beginning, when I found out that my son had died, I had waited for a week. I had waited for them to come and tell me how sorry they were. And I was willing to accept that because I didn't know what happened. But then when they went and they threatened his father that if he was to say anything to anybody, that he would be next. And they have never, never apologized, not any of them. The Border Patrol has made it very ugly down here. They have not even improved nothing. They've only made things worse.
Angelita Ramon speaking with Wake Up Call's Deepa Fernandez about her son's death at the hands of the Border Patrol near Tucson, Arizona. Gay rights advocates have recently rallied in several Polish cities to protest the banning of a gay rights march a week prior and to demand tolerance and freedom of speech from Poland's new conservative leaders. Poland is already under a warning from the EU not to attempt to limit the rights of gays and lesbians. Danuta Zafraniec reports from Warsaw.
More than 1,000 protesters assembled in the center of Warsaw demanding tolerance, freedom of speech and the right of assembly, especially for gays. Simultaneous demonstrations took place in many cities this weekend, organized by the Campaign Against Homophobia in Poland. The marches were a response to the brutal police breakup of a similar march in Poznań a week before, when heavily armed riot police arrested more than 65 gays and lesbians who refused to disband when they attempted to hold a gay pride march. Many of Warsaw's inhabitants, like this 52-year-old woman, took part to show support not only for sexual minorities, but everything else deemed in Poland as different.
Why are you here?
Because this is really a case for fighting, for keeping the democracy. We are fed up with homophobia in Poland and with the opinion that we're crazy. Homophobia is wrong. We are far away from understanding that we're living in the world which is really primarily heterosexual, but it doesn't mean that that's normality. And we think that those processes which are happening now in Poland are really very dangerous because it's a straight road to totalitarian society, and we don't want to allow that.
Robert Biedroń is with Campaign Against Homophobia, which organized the protests.
We came here to protest against the dictatorship of newly elected government who tries to separate some minority groups from the society. Gays and lesbians, heterosexual people, black and white, disabled came here to reanimate democracy. Again, like during communist dictatorship, came on the street to defend the human rights. That's something what shows that government, even though it has police, even though it has power to put us in prisons, it's not able to stop democracy.
Opposition politicians also participated in the march. Izabela Jaruga-Nowacka is Poland's former deputy premier and social affairs minister. She is with the SLD, Social Democratic Party, accused by the new conservative government of promoting homosexuality.
All citizens, independent of their own way of life, independent of the color of the skin or religion, have the right to protest and to choose their own way.
Simultaneously, about a dozen of far-right counter-demonstrators briefly taunted participants with insults, but there were no reports of violence that has marred earlier rallies. The countrywide campaign of support for equal rights for sexual minorities has stirred much discussion and controversy, both among Polish society and political elites who find homosexuality unacceptable. Meanwhile, the European Commission announced that if Polish government continues to oppose gay rights, Poland risks losing its voting rights in the European Union. I'm Danuta Szafraniec, Free Speech Radio News, Warsaw.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Aura Bogado.